From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Ahead of the most important presidential election of our lifetimes, there is a clear generational divide between voters, with older Americans tending toward President Donald Trump and younger voters toward Joe Biden. The mass protests against racist police brutality are dominated by younger people. And that is no accident. Young Americans live in a country that does not resemble what their parents experienced. The opportunity to live a debt-free life with a steady job and decent wages has nearly evaporated. It's no wonder that a poll earlier this year found that 83% of voters believed young people had the power to change the country, and 79% of young people say the COVID-19 pandemic has helped them realize that politics impact their everyday lives. We turn now to the author of a new book, Jill Filipovich. She is a journalist, lawyer, and author of The H-Spot, The Feminist Pursuit of Happiness, a weekly columnist for CNN, and a 2019 New America Future of War Fellow. She's also a contributing opinion writer to The New York Times and former columnist for The Guardian. Her work has appeared in Time magazine, The Washington Post, Foreign Policy, and other and the anthologies Nasty Women, Feminism, Resistance, and Revolution in Trump's America, and Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and a World Without Rape. She joins me to discuss her newest book. It's called OK Boomer, Let's Talk, How My Generation Got Left Behind. Welcome to the program, Jill.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So the word boomer, referring to baby boomers, it's an interesting phenomenon that has highlighted this clash between generations sometime before the pandemic reared its head. This was in the past year or two, something that became sort of an internet meme. But who are the two generations that this battle is being fought between? I feel like I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm 45. I'm neither a boomer, but am I even really a millennial? So who are these generations that are fighting?
So I think you're a Gen Xer, which is between millennials and baby boomers. Baby boomers are born roughly between 1946 and 1964. Just below them are Gen Xers, who are 1965 to about 1979. And then you have millennials, who are born between, again, these are kind of rough outlines, but 1980 and 1996. And then younger than them, you have Gen Zers. And I wrote the book because millennials and boomers are the two biggest generations in America. So boomers were the largest generation when they were young adults. They continued to be the largest generation in America until just a couple of years ago when millennials surpassed them. And so to me, it's of great interest to see how did these two enormous generations, both of which have pretty profoundly reshaped American society, what did they have access to? How did they, what kind of world did they come into? What opportunities did they have? And what challenges did they face?
So the retort, okay, boomer, is seen as a serious insult. It's, the response to it from folks who identify, who are in the generation of baby boomers, has been very strong. People feel deeply insulted by being referred to in this way. But is it really that insulting? It has been denounced as ageism.
Yeah, I mean, I think boomers can kind of get over it, honestly. I understand the complaints. But OK Boomer really is, I think, a Gen Z and then millennial retort to years of being maligned. So there's this whole internet, Fox News, conservative boomer outrage complex really directed at focusing on everything young people are doing wrong. And I often use the word millennial as kind of a catch-all for young people. And this is where you read articles about how the reason millennials can't afford their homes is because we're spending all of our money on avocado toast. All the things that college students who are no longer millennials, all the things that college students are doing wrong. So we've really been pummeled by boomer news outlets and frankly by boomer political policies. And if boomers have their feelings hurt by OK Boomer as a phrase, I mean, that's fair. But we've really been on the receiving end of the insults for much, much longer.
It seems as though a big part of the conversation that is not necessarily being named out loud by, you know, the older generation that critiques younger folks is the issue of government policies. You have a country where an older generation of Americans took great advantage of government support, government policies, and then through their votes, through supporting conservative policies, essentially supported the dismantling of the very framework that they benefited from and are now sort of cannot fathom that younger folks aren't able to make it and don't acknowledge that those very structures have been dismantled. Is that the heart of the conversation?
That's exactly right. When boomers were coming of age, they had a ladder up to the middle class and frankly often higher. And that was a ladder that was built for them by their parents and their elders. And folks that, you know, decided, okay, we want a more educated population, and so we're going to make higher education more affordable. People need a place to live. We're going to make housing more affordable. We're going to make it more accessible. We're going to build the kind of housing that people want to live in.
And also, of course, all of these structures were racialized, which I know you address in your book.
Absolutely. You know, these were not on offer to every single baby boomer. And, you know, certainly things like housing were radically racially discriminatory and continue to be. But overall, there were efforts to at least help some baby boomers, and frankly, a majority of the baby boom generation, which was, you know, about 80% white when boomers were coming of age. So these structures were in place, and no, they didn't help every baby boomer, and certainly Black and Hispanic baby boomers and baby boomers of color generally, including immigrants, were very much left out of some of these promises. But what white baby boomers did after, you know, climbing these ladders that were constructed for them was they pulled them up behind them. So cost of education has gone radically up. Costs of housing have gone radically up. Many of the sort of invisible helping hands that federal and state government extended to baby boomers, it was invisible. And so boomers, you know, not all boomers, certainly, but many boomers, and especially the conservative ones, tend to have a narrative of themselves as, you know, well, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, and why are the kids today so lazy and entitled and whatever, when in reality, those same conservative baby boomers have completely obliterated the same ladder that they climbed for the younger generations.
It seems that climate change is also a very important symbol of the kind of generational divide where young people are seeing the writing on the wall, are seeing that they may not have a future because of the fossil fuel-based industries that boomers have championed at the expense of their lives. And then these very powerful youth-dominated grassroots movements for climate justice are routinely denigrated and derided and belittled by older conservatives. That's a big part of it too, right?
That's right. And frankly, a lot of older conservatives don't even believe that climate change is caused by human behavior. So when we can't even agree on the very, very basic scientific premise of this question, that what people do causes changes in the temperature of our climate, which in turn makes things like the current wildfires that we're seeing rage across not just California, but much of the world, significantly worse, that causes, you know, the ice caps to melt and rising sea levels, flooding. And we can't even agree on the basic premise. And when that basic premise that climate change is real, that it's caused by human behavior, is turned into a partisan political issue, as it's been in the United States, which is simply not the case in much of the rest of the world, it becomes impossible to do anything meaningful to change it. And so if you've seen, you know, the Republican Party, which is very much the party of white people, it is very much the party of older people, it's very much party of men. As you have seen the Republican Party turn climate change into this, you know, partisan battle instead of something that affects all of us that we needed to do something about yesterday, you see, in turn, the Republican Party base, which is disproportionately white boomer, adopt that same frame. And, you know, so yes, it's an age divide, but it's also one of those places where age and this kind of conservative machine that has overtaken the sort of boomer media universe. It's one of those spaces where you can really see that political machine in its most extreme and dangerous operation.
Would it be fair to say that younger Americans, because of the situation they find themselves in, are a lot more supportive of the idea of socialism than older Americans? And then this has been then seized on by the older conservatives in our nation as younger people just looking for a government handout.
Yes, I think you see this play out pretty clearly in the polling that, you know, really the only group of people in the U.S. that doesn't have a pretty poor idea about socialism are younger folks. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. You know, I think folks that are especially younger millennials and Gen Zers didn't grow up at a time when the Cold War was raging, right? So they don't have that same context of socialism as a big national enemy. What many of us have instead is, you know, we look at countries like Sweden and Denmark and Norway, and, you know, we see these social democracies that, you know, aren't about Russian breadlines, but rather are places where nobody has five-figure student loan debt unless they went to school in the U.S., where people are able to feed their families, where you have relatively low rates of homelessness, where everybody has affordable health care. And for, you know, for a lot of us, I think that understandably looks pretty good.
There was a recent index that was just released. This is a world index that comes out every few years, the Social Progress Index, that out of 163 nations worldwide, the United States, Brazil, and Hungary are the only ones in which people are worse off now than when the index was started to be documented in 2011. And the U.S. fall on that index was the greatest of all falls, which is really kind of shocking. This nation has, the index found, some of the most important medical innovation and yet the most unequal access to healthcare. So it's become this nation of extremes, which I suppose is also reflected in our statistics of wealth and income, the richer getting richer, the poorer getting poorer, and that's actually accelerating under the pandemic. What's also not addressed often by the older conservatives who like to make fun of millennials is that millennials are actually possibly working harder than their parents did. They're employed by largely a gig economy, right? Are they in fact working harder?
So certainly Americans are working harder, which suggests that, you know, the younger folks who are more dominant in the workplace are working harder. Americans today work almost an extra month per year than they did, I believe, in 1980, when boomers were about the same age as millennials are now. So when boomers were, you know, young adults starting families, many, many more millennials than boomers report, you know, working multiple jobs, cobbling together, you know, a series of gigs or part-time work just to make ends meet. You know, and of course, the outcome of that is if you have a bunch of part-time work and you don't have a full-time employer, you also, you know, may not have employer-sponsored health insurance. You may not be able to pay into a retirement account. All of these benefits that we have attached to full-time employment, in an era in which full-time employment is going by the wayside for many young people, mean that many of us just don't have, not only are we struggling month to month, but we don't have the basic safety net that many of our parents had. You know, you see this, of course, with things like health insurance, which is why you see so many young people who are big proponents of some sort of universal healthcare, or frankly, asking for Medicare for all, which boomers love, but don't seem to want to share with younger folks.
Right, they love because they literally have Medicare for all boomers. Everybody over the age of 65 has access to Medicare.
Exactly. And they love it. And, you know, millennials, I think one of the messages that I'm trying very hard to get across in the book is not that, you know, millennials hate boomers or that we want to take something that's theirs. My argument is that we just want a fair share. You know, you talked about income and you talked about inequality in your earlier question and this new report that came out, and how much all of these benefits have been concentrated among a tiny, tiny number of people. And that's a racial story, it's an income story, it's a wealth story, but it's also an age story. So when boomers were young adults, when they were a couple years older than millennials are now on average, they held something like 20% of America's wealth. Millennials, who now are the largest generation of adults in the United States, the youngest millennials are 24, the oldest are 40, we hold 3% of American wealth.
Oh my goodness. And of course, the reaction to that, I'm guessing, is, well, you're just not smart enough or working hard enough to get where I did.
Which is sort of bizarre. I mean, in that same period of time, U.S. GDP has increased, you know, something like 70%. So, you know, we're producing more, we're in a wealthier country, and yet far less of that wealth is going into millennials' hands. You know, it's not about how many hours you work or how hard you work. It very much is about what policies have we set up to make sure that there is sort of an equitable distribution of resources. And when boomers were growing up, resources were distributed more equitably. The rich paid much more in taxes. You had far fewer people that were these kind of hyper rich. And frankly, the bottom was higher. You know, we often talk about how explosive things have gotten up on the tippy top. But I think what we often neglect is how far the bottom has fallen out. So one of the reasons, for example, that you see so many millennials go to college is because you now need a college degree in order to basically make what a high school graduate would have made in the late 1970s. So a college degree is the new bottom. And wages have fallen so low for folks without a college degree that is primarily what makes up the difference between those with just a high school education and those with a college education. It's that those on the lower end have fallen tremendously, not that those on the kind of higher end or even middle end have grown so much.
Right, the federal minimum wage remains at a ridiculously low $7.25, I believe, an hour. Just quite shocking that the minimum wage remains so low. And of course, these college graduates graduate with massive debt that hangs over them, that stands in the way of them being able to purchase a home or decide whether they have children or not. That's another thing, right? How are millennial views of family, marriage, and relationships changing, in part because of the economic differences today, but also because they tend to be more socially liberal?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. What you certainly see is that millennial views of things like marriage, parenthood, sex are much, much more open-minded and progressive than what our parents saw. We are very much kind of like a live and let live generation, right? As long as you're not hurting anybody else, you go live your best life, seems to kind of be our ethos. But on an individual level, when pollsters ask millennials, you know, and young people generally, what do you want in your life? A lot of folks are actually pretty traditional. You know, people do want to get married. They do want to have kids. They do want to own a home. The gap isn't, but in reality, millennials don't do those things at the same level as our parents, right? We're much less likely to be married. We have children later. We have fewer children. We're much less likely to own a home. And, you know, the part of the gap is choice. And I, as a feminist, I think that's great that folks can, you know, wait longer to get married and wait to have kids or not have kids. Those are all choices I've made in my own life. But what a lot of millennials say is that they want those things. They just don't seem possible. That in order to get married, you need to be, folks believe they need to be financially stable. And when you have tremendous student loan debt, or when, you know, you're a millennial who didn't go to college and so you only have a high school degree and you are making that minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, you don't feel like you have the financial maturity to get married. And so a lot you see, especially among working class millennials, really, really low rates of marriage despite an aspiration to marriage. And same with childbearing. You see a lot of millennials who say, I would like to have children, I would like to have another child, but I work too much and I don't have time, or I don't make enough money. You know, childcare in this country is extraordinarily expensive.
That is another one of those invisible things that boomers were able to take advantage of, that they didn't have astronomically high cost childcare as we do now.
And they have fewer two-parent working families. I mean, a lot of boomers went into the workforce, but many, many did not. Many worked part-time.
Because they could, right? Because the working partner in the family probably earned enough to support a whole family.
Exactly. And that's just not possible now. You know, you also have millennials taking into account what we talked about earlier, which is climate change. And many of us say that, you know, it's usually not a decisive factor, but that one factor in our childbearing decisions is, you know, is it even ethical to bring a child or another child onto a planet that is flooding and burning and doesn't have enough resources to support the people that are already here? So these are huge questions, you know, that millennials are grappling with in some of the most intimate parts of our lives, because so many of the resources that boomers had on offer are just not available to us.
Is there an epidemic of depression among millennials as a result of everything that's happening?
Millennial mental health is shockingly poor. The one thing I will say that I think millennials have going for us, and this is even more true among Gen Zers, is we know it. Yeah, I think among baby boomers and certainly folks older than them, there was a lot of denialism around mental health and a lot of stigma and a sense that, you know, if you talk about depression or anxiety, that's showing weakness. Millennials do have pretty shockingly high rates of depression, but we know it. Where that gets really frustrating is that we are underinsured, and Obamacare helped with some of that. That insured a tremendous number of millennials. But often, you know, we're on the kind of worst of the worst plans. Mental health coverage is limited. And millennials are also even more likely than boomers to have healthcare debt, even though we are less likely to use the healthcare system. So we're depressed. We know we need help. We're willing to seek out that help, but huge numbers of us can't afford to.
So finally, let's also talk about the hope aspect of this conversation, the fact that there are young people leading protests against racial injustice and leading protests against climate change, that are also now running for office, that are realizing that it's not enough to just vote, but also not enough to ignore the electoral system. Does all of that give you hope? We have some very, very powerful, eloquent, articulate young people in Congress now that are millennials and that have their counterparts in the streets.
It gives me a tremendous amount of hope. Watching the Black Lives Matter protests all summer long was so incredibly invigorating and inspiring, and, you know, a real bright point in what has felt like a very, very dark year. And those were very, very much youth-led movements, you know, millennials, but also Gen Zers, folks younger than millennials, you know, and picking up the torch from obviously folks who have come before, right, including a huge number of baby boomers who have been working on these issues for a long time. So it's not sort of purely generational conflicts there. I very much saw that as an incredibly powerful interracial, intergenerational movement that I found really inspiring. As for the millennials in Congress, you know, folks like AOC, folks like Lauren Underwood, some of the most exciting young politicians are indeed millennials. And I'm hoping that we'll see, and I imagine we will see, many more of them elected this November to Congress. You know, that said, millennials are still pretty criminally underrepresented in Congress. There's not a single millennial in the Senate. And millennials only make up about 6.6% of House seats, you know, which is not nothing. But certainly baby boomers, even when they were in their 30s, did make up a higher... There are several baby boomers in the Senate when they were in their 30s. And certainly baby boomers dominated politics at a younger age and then continued to dominate politics for several decades thereafter. And, you know, we're still seeing that boomer dominance. So I'm optimistic that is shifting. I wish it would have shifted earlier. And I'm hoping that this November we see an even bigger push of young folks into elected office at every level.
Jill, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Jill Filipovich, journalist, lawyer, and author of The H Spot, The Feminist Pursuit of Happiness. She's a weekly columnist for CNN and a 2019 New America Future of War Fellow. She's also a contributing opinion writer to The New York Times, former columnist for The Guardian. We've been talking about her newest book. It's called OK Boomer, Let's Talk, How My Generation Got Left Behind. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.